Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, welcome to another edition of the Detroit Football Network podcast, coming to you from Ford Field. I'm Stoney. He is Justin Rogers. And JR, 48-42 in a game that I don't think was as close as the final score.
Hold on. Okay. We lost JR. I don't know where he went, but he all of a sudden the screen went to just you.
Okay. I did see that, but I thought that was you were like playing Mr. Director.
I don't know what happened. I think it was my fault, but
that's okay.
Sorry about that.
Here we go.
There you go. Good.
Better than the middle.
Yeah. 3-2-1. Welcome to another edition of the Detroit Football Network podcast, coming to you live from Ford Field, where the Lions were defeated by the Buffalo Bills in a wild, weird game, 48-42. He's Justin Rogers. I'm Stoney. And Justin, first of all, I didn't think the game was as close as the final score indicated. There are so many things we can talk about. But from my vantage point, the story of the game was the trenches, and the Lions just got completely eaten up alive. And that was, to me, from the get-go, where they couldn't run the ball early, fell behind 14-0, had no pressure whatsoever on Allen, and they couldn't do anything defensively. And the quite honest, very disappointing performance by the offensive line as well.
Yeah,
even before we get into the secondary.
Yeah, let's start with the defensive line. I actually thought they did have some pressure early, and that's why you saw Allen rolling from the pocket, scrambling, making some throws on the run. But the problem was they couldn't get home. There was the one where Allen stepped up in the pocket, realized he had nowhere to go, stepped back in the pocket, then ran left and found his running back. And it's like, well, there's a reason this guy is one of the least sacked quarterbacks in the NFL, if not the least sacked. I think Buffalo had the lowest sack rate on pass drops coming into this contest, and it's because of Allen. You know, I mean, not to take away everything from the offensive line, they're clearly blocking reasonably well, but he's so difficult. His feel in the pocket is tremendous. His ability to throw on the move is elite. And, you know, the pressure did not sustain in this game, obviously, but I mean, that was a really remarkable performance, really two remarkable performances from quarterbacks today. But Allen in particular, I think he solidified everything we've thought about him as kind of the front runner for the MVP in this contest.
Yeah. Who had former Lion Ty Johnson on their bingo card for being a major contributor, especially in the first half?
I mean, not to this degree. I mentioned him in my pregame notes because he has been playing well. They've got kind of a weird three-headed running back monster there. It's obviously led by Cook, and it should be, but Johnson and the rookie who's
Davis.
Thank you. Are kind of splitting the second and third reps, kind of about equal in snaps this year. And Ty Johnson's been playing pretty well. He's had some moments this season, but I felt this, and I tweeted this during the game, like this was the first time I felt like you could really feel the absence of Alex Anzalone. They took advantage of some of the newcomers there at linebacker, and it's not that they're not decent individual players, but you know, they're still kind of getting their feet wet in the scheme. And you saw some coverage lapse from Turner, Ezekiel Turner. You saw Quan Alexander get beat on one of those. And Jamal Adams is chasing down plays from behind. And you know, that's where Anzalone's so assignment sound in coverage. He's in the right place. And even if he gives up a catch, usually it's the tackle is made immediately. Even Malcolm Rodriguez, is really good at covering those wheel routes as a former safety. And so I felt like you felt the absence of some of their depth at linebacker today after, all these injuries they've played through and kind of gotten over. you know, they couldn't survive today against really the best offense they've seen all season and will see all season.
Yeah, but look, Buffalo was able to run the ball, mm-hmm. and the Lions, they couldn't run the ball. And it's a I don't know, for me, it's a growing concern. Last two games, last week it was 3.3 yards a carry against Green Bay. This week, even worse, 3.2 yards. And for this offense, I can sit there and say, what are you talking about? The offense looked great. They had 42 points. But for this offense to do what it's supposed to do, they have to run the football.
Well, and they knew that. They knew controlling the clock, sustained drives, keeping the ball out of Josh Allen's hands was going to be key to not pulling off an upset, but pulling off a victory against a team that, you know, came into town having scored 30 and 7 straight. Like, this is one of the most consistent offenses in NFL history. I mean, they became today the fifth team to score 30 straight in 8 games in the first since 2013. I mean, you look at the teams that have done that. It's a couple of the Patriots teams with Brady and Moss. It's the greatest show on turf. I mean, it's these elite offenses that have, you know, we remember historically, and that's what the Bills are doing right now. So, you know, if you can't bottle up their quarterback, it's a problem.
Yeah, I thought going into the game when I saw their inactives and all the problems they were going to have in the secondary, yeah. You know, I'm usually very pessimistic. I felt good about this game. You know, the fact that the Lions were getting, you know, Reader and, you know, Luzerike and Pascal back, I said, you know, finally they're starting to get whole a little bit, and they just couldn't do anything. And part of the reasons you mentioned is basically Josh Allen. And you can't, against a team like Buffalo, you can't go 3 and out and then basically 1 first down and punt. You can't go punt in your first two possessions. And in the second half, you can't go 3 and out and then fumble. I mean, that's huge. That's 4 possessions where you get nothing. And then you add on to the one that Bates missed a field goal. And it'll counteract, you know, them missing a real chip shot. But 5 empty possessions, really. And that's, you can't do that against a team like Buffalo.
Yeah, it's weird. It made me think in some ways of the 2022 Seattle game, which I think was 48-45. So, you know, a similar explosion of points. But that one, you know, it was more of a toe-to-toe matchup. And then Goff had the one really critical mistake. I don't know if it was a pick six or just an interception deep in their own territory. I can't remember the details entirely. But, you know, it was just the one big mistake that they could never dig out of the hole. And, you know, I probably speaks to how much better they are overall as a unit, that the fact that they were able to still claw their way back into this one. And I want to call it a chance at the end there, I guess. If you recover the onside kick, you got a Hail Mary. It's a chance. It's, you know, the door is open, but you said it off the top and you were right. Like, it really never was that close. After Buffalo scored the opening touchdown of the second half, it was a 2-score game at least for the duration of the second half until Jameson Williams touchdown with 12 seconds left. And, you know, that's not competitive. It's not as competitive as the final score would lead you to believe. And so, you know, it's a disappointing one, but, you know, I think the point that's interesting to me, and it's one that I made with Zach on Wednesday, when I picked the Lions to lose this game. And I waffled like you did when I saw how many secondary members they had out, but I do think there's value in losing this game. You know, you go in and you have this 11 game winning streak and you're winning all these different ways and your confidence is probably through the roof as it should be. But, you know, I think they needed this wake up call, this recalibration, this reminder that, yeah, it's not going to be that easy. You're not going to waltz over the entire league. You're not going to walk into a Super Bowl for the first time ever and just beat everybody along the way. Like, that was the unrealistic path. And so, you know, this whole slogan they have, right? It takes more. But maybe they needed a reminder. It takes more. And today provides that reminder that it's not going to be easy. There's still a lot of work to be done. And it starts right now with these 3 remaining games to lock up the number one seed.
Right. Because if they win out, they're the number one seed, no matter mm-hmm. what Philadelphia does. So that's good news. And, you know, Chicago next. Chicago probably, because they play Minnesota Monday night, will be going into that game with an 8-game losing streak. So You know, that basically that game's maybe their Super Bowl next Sunday. And so you're right. It won't be easy. Let's talk about some of the guys who really played well for the Lions. And obviously you got to start with Goff. I mean, to pass for 494 yards.
Well, do you got any defensive touchdowns. Players on that list, Stoney?
What'd you say?
Do you have any defensive players on that list?
Not one.
Okay.
Not yeah. one.
No.
But well, I'm going to be optimistic.
Okay.
I'll be, you know, giving the kudos first. Okay. Goff was great. He really was. Yeah. Now, there were some, even the statistics were, you know, obviously Buffalo's not, I wouldn't say they were playing, you know, bend but not break, but, you know, some of the statistics might be misleading. But early in the game, St. Brown, he had a drop or two. There were some uncharacteristic things by the wide receivers. And so as good as St. Brown was, you got to give Goff the MVP of the game, if you want to even go that far, for the Lions. 38 of 59, 494. He did get sacked three times. He showed some pretty good escapability, too, considering how Ed Oliver played in that game. Five touchdowns. And he was able to rush the ball two times for 13 yards, which was nice. So the Lions should have no issues with Jared Goff.
No, I actually thought it was one of his best games in a Detroit uniform. And I'm not just saying that strictly from a statistical standpoint, because via straight statistics, yeah, obviously 494 yards, five touchdowns, no picks. One of the national writers, Adam Schefter, so, you know, put out one of the Otani Trout style stats, if you will. No quarterback has ever lost a game with more than 400 touchdowns, more than 400 yards, five touchdowns, and no picks. And so there you go, Goff. You become a first in a category you don't want to be first in. But what really impressed me, I think, was some of his touches on those middle field passes, the deeper ones over the linebackers in front of the safeties. The one to St. Brown for the 66-yard touchdown is a great example. I thought Goff showed tremendous touch. The touchdown to Tim Patrick was phenomenal. You talked about the escapability. Well, he rolled out of the pocket, could have ran, probably wouldn't have got it. But what he did is he kind of angled his run laterally, forced the defender to make a decision, drew away Tim Patrick's coverage, then dumped it off. You see a lot of great dual-threat quarterbacks pull that out of their play set. And that's not a Goff strength. He's not a dual threat guy. We know that. He's not unathletic, but he's not athletic relative to this era of quarterbacks. But that was a incredibly savvy, incredibly athletic play. And I think just shows the continued evolution of him as a quarterback. I mean, this for all the negatives that are going to come out of this game and the negative feelings, like, Goff's going to do his film review this week and probably feel pretty damn good. And he should. Should be confidence building for him.
And then there was another play in that game that, you know, if you think about it now, it's a negative for J-Mo, but it wouldn't have counted anyway because of a holding penalty, right? Or I think it would have been called back anyway. But the bomb he threw to Jamison Williams that Jamison Williams dropped.
Yeah.
Goff can throw the ball deep, and I mean, he showed that.
Yeah.
On that play as well.
I've said this before. When he got here, it was a narrative because it was true. Jared Goff wasn't a great deep ball passer. It was more of an accuracy issue than an arm strength issue. It almost felt like he was mitigating risks by throwing the ball a little too long or a little too close to the sideline. You know, if your guy can't catch it, well, neither can the other guy. And there's something probably to that mindset. I don't know how Sean McVay penalized interceptions, maybe, you know, made him play a little scared. I don't know what it was, but I feel like some point in 2022, when, you know, he had a little bit more of an arsenal than he did in 2021, like, Goff kind of buried that narrative, and we're now 3 years into it. And is he the best deep ball passer in the league? No, he's no. There's obviously some guys thrive in that. Lamar Jackson might be the best deep ball passer in the league, but Goff can hold his own there, and he can put an accurate deep ball on the sideline, down the middle. And quite honestly, it feels like the Lions haven't been doing enough of it lately.
There was the Dan Skipper touchdown, and we should give him some credit.
We should spend 20 minutes on it.
A child in the next 24 hours, as well as his wife is about to be induced. But that was a great play. He was wide open, and somebody called on our post-game show. Now, I don't know if this is even out. I don't know if this is true, but Skipper is what, 6'9"? Is that what he's listed at?
That is what he's listed as, yeah.
Okay. So
maybe even 6'10".
Okay.
Either way, he's huge.
Somebody suggested it's probably the tallest guy to ever catch a touchdown in the NFL. Harold Carmichael, I don't think, was 6'9 or 6'10". I think he was like 6'8". And there was a guy who played for the Chiefs that I should have looked up, Morris Stroud, who might have been taller. But other than that, he could be the guy.
Oh, I bet I could look that up. I don't know if I could look it up during the podcast, but I do have some ability to find that information. But what do you want to call him, 6'9"?
Yeah, let's call him 6'9".
All right. Well, I'll kind of peck away at that. But so okay. I got a chance to talk to Skipper as he was kind of hurriedly getting dressed, and I, you know, was trying not to distract him and ask questions and, you know, allow him to multitask. But apparently his wife went into, I'm throwing around medical terms that maybe I shouldn't, but false labor last Wednesday. And so right before that Packers game, they were going to the hospital on Wednesday because she believes she was experiencing contractions. And so he's supposed to start that game, if you remember.
Right.
Decker's out. So, you know, that family's been through the ringer a little bit this week with just the expecting of their daughter. This was a little bit more controlled environment. She went in there for a controlled induction. He knew he was, you know, going to be safe to play the game, and she was in the hospital with the best care. So it worked out. He made a special on-field memory. He's going to have a special off-field memory here after the game. And hey, you talk about the execution of the design. It's not a complex one. It's one the Lions run all the time with their tight ends. These, you block early, you sell the block, you release late into the flat, but you just don't see it that often with a tight end or with an offensive lineman. And so that's what makes it special. It was really, really cool to see him get in the end zone and, you know, continued creativity from Ben Johnson. We saw it multiple times this game, including the double pass early in the game that is just forgotten about because
yes,
they lost and there was a million points. But that was an important play for the Lions because it sparked their offense. And I believe that was the drive, their first drive that ended in a touchdown when they were down 14-0. So they really needed that at the time.
And even the flea flicker they did late to help set up a touchdown, although it was like, okay, who cares? But yeah, Ben Johnson will call plays no matter what the situation is. All right. After the break, we'll focus more on the injury situation and a little bit of the defense, especially in the defensive secondary. It's coming up next, Detroit Football Network podcast.
The results are in. Great conversations are always on par. So follow and listen to On Par with me, Maury Povich, wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Well, our crack staff, meaning Justin Rogers, did the research, and I feel pretty good about myself.
It just
shows you how freaking old I am that I remember Morris Stroud of the Kansas City Chiefs was 6'10". And he caught a couple of touchdown passes in his career. And that was the tallest player in NFL history to score a touchdown. Dan Skipper.
Receiving touchdown.
Receiving touchdown. Dan Skipper among three others at 6'9".
By the way, Stroud had 7 touchdowns. I don't know how you pulled that name out of your ass, let's be honest. But 1969 NFL draft, played from 69 to 74. I don't know. You must have read. You must have read some Sports Illustrated article on him when you were a kid.
No, I remember watching. I watched the AFL too.
All right, I was trying to make you younger than you are.
No,
and you just ruined it. Dan Skipper is one of 4 players now, 6'9" or taller to catch a touchdown. Stroud obviously leading the pack, 6'10", 7 scores. Jonathan Ogden apparently caught a touchdown.
Whoa.
Yeah, did not.
Yeah, he's a Hall of Famer, right? I assume, or will be Hall of Famer.
He is in the Hall of Fame, and
yeah,
he should be. He was
so dominant. Stroud at least caught touchdown passes from a Hall of Famer. At least I think Len Dawson's in the Hall of Fame, or at least should be. Anyway,
by the way, Ogden had 2. And somebody set off the fire alarm here at Ford Field. That's going to be good for the sound effects. Also, Alejandro Villanueva, Steelers.
Formerly of the tackle. Pittsburgh Steelers. Yeah, all right. Touchdown.
Lots of fun facts.
Yes. Now, the injury situation. that appeared to be getting better got way worse. First, Dorsey's done for the year with an injury that was described by Dan Campbell as much like Aiden Hutchinson's. So he's gone. Carlton Davis with a hit. At first, they put him on a concussion protocol, something with a jaw injury. Mm-hmm. And I figured he just wouldn't come back and maybe miss the game. But according to Dan Campbell, there's a good chance he's done for the year. And then Aleem McNeil with an injury that, once again, nothing quite official, but it appears might be out for the year as well. And it's nuts. I mean, it's just when will it stop? When will it stop? Yeah. And how, you know, people, you know, you don't want to use injuries as excuses, but sometimes they're facts. And how long can a team continue to survive with all their best players on one particular unit gone?
Yeah, look, if this is the thing that ends up keeping the Lions from a Super Bowl this year, that's really disappointing for the fans. Because this thing was built to not just succeed, but it was built on depth to overcome a lot. And with anything, there's limits, and they're not going to give up. You know, they're going to do their best to backfill, and they're going to instill the same standard and belief in all these guys. And we've seen them overcome so much more than we already thought they could overcome many, many times already. But you're right. I mean, it is ridiculous. It does feel like there's a breaking point at some point. And man, Carlton Davis is a really big blow. And I know he's missed a little bit of time already this season. It feels like he comes off the field for a couple plays each game because of how physical he is. And you know, this is a great example of it. He got hurt twice in this game. First, he kind of jammed his broken hand, and then he made a diving tackle attempt where he looks like he took like a knee to the face, essentially. And both of those were emblematic of who he is. They were run plays. You know, he's a cornerback that throws his nose into the mix on run plays. And that's why you love him, because he puts forth that type of effort. And, you know, it's, you know, now the cause for why he's going to be out of the lineup. And, it's going to be really interesting to see what the Lions do. You know, they kind of handcuff themselves a little bit with their options going to this game because they made Emmanuel Mosley inactive. I don't disagree with that decision. I understood why they did it, just given where they needed depth elsewhere. But Mosley might suddenly become really important.
Yep, it's his time to shine. I mean, they've given him enough chances with all his injuries. Not his fault, obviously. But, man, this is the time for Emmanuel Mosley to show why the Lions got him 2 years ago. He hasn't had a chance to play much. So that would be a blessing. Man, I don't know what else you do. You obviously, Broderick Martin will be activated again.
Probably not playing cornerback, though.
No, but playing for McNeil, I would assume.
So let me pose kind of what I think is going to happen here. McNeil probably will replace Levi. Mm-hmm. I think that makes the most sense in terms of three tech defensive tackle. You put Levi next to Reader, and then you use Jonah Williams in that Levi role a little bit more. Cornerback, I have options here, and I'd like to hear what you think might be your favorite of the options. Obviously, first one, Kendall Vildor. You just go with the guy that's been the backup for a long time, and you plug him in there, and you call it a day. I know that Lions fans right now are shaking in their boots at that prospect, but he's not as bad as you think he is, but also does have his rocky moments. Alternatively, you move Amik Robertson outside and you put Mosley in the slot. That's kind of where they were going in the start of training camp before Mosley tore his pec. So you go Mosley nickel, Amik outside, or you flip that. You keep Amik on the nickel and you put Mosley on the outside. And then there's one other possibility that is interesting, and probably not right away, but Ennis Rakestraw is due to come off of IR. His window to return expired after this game. He could return to practice next week. I asked Dan Campbell about him earlier this last week. He said that, you know, they'll make that assessment, but look, they might need a guy. Another guy that might be coming off IR too is Melifonwu. And I know nobody wants to bank on Melifonwu right now. Totally get it. But, you know, who's to say that maybe he can't play some nickel as well and let you move Amik Robertson. So
let me ask you one other crazy option.
All right.
Can Branch play corner?
I think Brian Branch can do anything, but I would not move him from safety. He's too impactful there.
You're weakening one position to hopefully help patch another one.
Yeah, I would keep him. If anything, I would move him to more of a nickel safety hybrid. So maybe you have him more in the box on base downs or base packages. And then, I think you could have him a little bit more in cover. But I don't know. They have it'll be really interesting to see how Glenn kind of patches that one. And I guess we can't dismiss, like, Dorsey was maybe the best gunner in football. And I've watched all 64 gunners in football, but like, I know that Jack Fox is on pace to set the NFL record for net punting average. And while Jack Fox plays a huge role in that, obviously, so does his coverage. And the first guy down on coverage almost every single time, forcing fair catches, making tackles, downing the ball at the 1 yard line, is Khalil Dorsey. So now you got to replace that as well. And that's, you know, Breakstraw fits in the mix there. Vildor fits in the mix there. But like, that's a downgrade. And you could see a little bit of change in how they punt. You might see Fox focus a little bit more on hang time than distance just because he doesn't have that elite gunner on the outside. They took a little bit of hit everywhere in this game.
All right. Speaking of hits, the head coach has taken a little bit of a hit. And I'm sure on the national shows, we'll take a ton more. We come back with the Detroit Football Network podcast. We'll assess the controversy with Dan Campbell right here. Detroit Football Network podcast.
Why does it feel like nobody really gives us the inside scoop? Join us on The Powers That Be, the podcast where insiders from Puck break down who has influence, how they use it, and what it actually means for you. New episodes every weekday. Listen to The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, back with the Detroit Football Network podcast. The Lions cut the lead to 10 points at one point in this football game with about 12 minutes left. And the Lions, as you know, their defense wasn't really doing much. So Dan Campbell opted with 12 minutes left to go the onside kick, which with the new rule where there's no deception, really, you have to announce it, which is a stupid-ass rule. Anyway, I just think it is. I mean, the part of football is being deceptive, and they take that away. All right, that being said, that's not an excuse. They score to go 38-28. And then they go and get the onside, and they go for the onside kick with 12 minutes left to play. And they kick it, as you saw, it bounced high, and got to give them credit. Mac Hollins returns it, 38 yards to the 5 yard line, they score. Now, when they declared it, I said to Scott the Gator Anderson, I said, you know what? I don't have a problem with this. And here's the reason.
I'm a little surprised at that. I like it. Go ahead.
Okay. The reason is, number one, your defense was awful. Okay. So they can't stop anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody who's against this, are throwing out, well, the percentage is 6% of recovery or whatever, 7%, whatever. That doesn't happen a lot. Granted. So if you're going to use the numbers, the percentages, analytics, whatever word you want to use, as your reason for hating this, let's use the analytics. Chances are, if the onside kick is not successful, but in a normal non-successful play, Buffalo will get the ball, let's say, somewhere between the 40 and 45 yard line probably.
Mm-hmm.
If the Lions kick the ball out of the end zone or touchback, Buffalo would get the ball at the 30 yard line. You're talking basically 30 yards. So to me, with your defense banged up, playing like shit, you take that chance of 7% that you're going to get another possession. I don't understand why that pisses people off so much.
Yeah, and if you force a field goal, you know, if your defense steps up, you're still a two-score game. I thought the other factor in it was, and I'm looking at the times of possession now, and maybe not as much as I thought, but, you know, I do wonder at some level if the defense was gassed, right? That the Lions had scored pretty quickly on the previous drive when they drove the length of field. It was it's like a minute and a half possession, 2 minute possession. And so it was kind of a quick strike drive. If I remember correctly, it was five straight passes for Goff, bang, 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 down the field, touchdown. And so not only are you, you know, trying to get the ball back at and you know, leave a varied path for a comeback, you're also giving your defense a potential breather when they need it. And so if you recover the onside kick, and this is like playing the two-point conversion game, you recover the onside kick, you go and you score a touchdown, now you need another defensive stop, and your defense is rested and motivated, energized from the whole situation. And so I understand what they were trying to do. And, of course, we're not us, apparently, but people are going to criticize it. And the fact that Mac Hollins recovered it the way he did and returned it all the way to the 5 yard line certainly makes it look like a terrible decision. Dan Campbell said that result actually made him regret the decision, which I don't know if I've ever heard him say he regrets a decision. So that was kind of interesting. But I actually thought the kick was pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, it had a nice high bounce. It was in an area where there could have been a collision and fumble. And look, it just happened to go to a guy with great hands who's an outstanding special teamer who played with a level heart rate and made the play. And so, you know, it is what it is. Yet they had to take a chance somewhere in that game because they weren't catching up in the traditional sense. And the chance backfired. And that's, you know, their odds of coming back in that game in general are probably 6%. So why not just risk it on the one play that's 6%?
Right. Here's the other question, though. I had no problem with after they scored to cut it back to 10 with the Gibbs touchdown, 45-35 with 8 minutes left. Why didn't you try it again if you were going to do it down, you know? But I understand why he did.
Here's two reasons why. One, your defense is actually more rested at that point, right? But two, you can only declare it twice in a game. So there's another stupid rule for you to get mad about. You can only kick onside kick twice in a game. So that was kind of like saving their timeouts, right? Saving your bullet for the final drive. And so, they needed that last attempt. Imagine if they didn't have that and they had to kick it off and just lose the game.
Right.
That would also made people pretty angry. So, it was a little quirky and a little weird and a little unconventional, but I'm the same as you. I don't have a particularly big problem with it. It doesn't matter whether you did it there, or you did it at 8 minutes, or you did it at 4 minutes. It was going to be a difficult ask to recover that kick regardless of the circumstance.
Yes.
I think probably the one thing people will ask is, why didn't you do the second one the first time? Because
That was
looked
close.
Like a much better play. I wish I knew who showed it to me. I don't know if it was Nolan Bianchi when Bates first signed, but I had seen that Bates had done kind of a similar kick at Arkansas. It was more of the surprise variety, but it was against Alabama and he recovered it. And so, you know, there was a history there. He knew what he was doing. I thought the kick was good. I thought he was pretty damn physical on the play and had a pretty good shot at it. And, you know, whatever. It's a bunch of collisions going on and guys scrambling for the ball, and it took a bad bounce and the Lions didn't get it. But, I mean, that's about as close as they come in this era to recovery.
By the way, not on the game itself, but just being around here, and before I came down to Ford Field, I watched the NFL Today, which was on CBS Live from Detroit with – you know, Burleson and J.J. Watt and James Brown and then the crew, Bill Cowher. And then Nance was on set. And Nance said, this game should decide who's America's team. He goes, because the Cowboys haven't held up that moniker truthfully for so long. And people, you know, you have two very similar, you know, fan bases, you know.
Sure.
Teams that haven't won. Now, granted, the Bills have been more successful than the Lions. And I was kind of surprised, thankfully, that there weren't more Bill fans in here. I thought I was under the impression that, you know, because I read that, you know, Bill's Mafia was taking over the Tin Roof bar for 2 days and all that, that there's going to be a lot of Bills fans here. There were some. I mean, you heard the cheers when they did stuff, but it wasn't crazy. And I think Lion fans pretty much showed it. And they were loud then, you know, whatever. And coming off the whole season ticket thing, I don't want to get into that right now. But, yeah.
But the getting the door price for this game was outlandish. And I mean, like, I'm not even saying, like, it. I don't know all the details about tickets, but I know Lions have some premium games, so this was probably priced as a premium game. Mm-hmm. I think I saw, like, the average get-in-the-door price, or maybe the lowest get-in-the-door price, was, like, $450 a ticket for this one on the secondary market. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of people asking me about the Buffalo fans in the stands online that weren't here, and I estimate it was only 5 to 10%, and if it was bigger, you would have saw at the end of the game after the onside kick, it emptied out in here pretty good. This was not the Jets Monday Night Football game where they were in mass behind their bench chanting their chants, right? Like this, the Bills had a decent presence, but it's nothing compared to the Lions on the road.
5% tops, and that's being generous, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right. So next up is the Bears. In Chicago, obviously, if the Lions, if they want to have the number one seed and have a bye, they have to win out, and that would start against Chicago, who will probably be coming off eight straight losses into that game. And then the Lions obviously go to San Francisco, a team that's really struggling, but, you know, who knows? They're still playing for something, I guess, in the back of their mind. They should be eliminated pretty soon anyway. But, you know, Dan Campbell likes to keep receipts. And that NFC Championship game is a receipt. So that should be a pretty interesting game. And then who knows what's going to happen with Minnesota. They still have to play the Packers, who's playing pretty well. So I look at it right now, worst case scenario is that the Lions don't get the number one seed and they open up here against Washington.
That's so
I just don't want – I don't want to deal with the whole Stafford crap again.
I think it's interesting. I feel like if you lose the number one seed, you're probably also going to lose the division.
Right.
You know, if you're going to be, you're going to take that, you're going to beat Chicago. You know, you've got to play Minnesota in week 18. And that's the game. I mean, it feels like that's just heading toward another primetime flex. So the Lions are going to close out the season on Monday Night Football, and Sunday Night Football is my guess. I mean, certainly, if the division and the number one seed are on the line, that is going to be the premium game.
Excuse my ignorance. Who else did Minnesota lose to besides the Lions?
The Rams on that controversial face mask call in the end zone.
So the Lions don't have to win that game.
Well, they do because they have. If Minnesota loses tomorrow, Minnesota wins tomorrow, they'll be equal in the standings, 12-2.
Correct. You're right.
Then they're going to play head to head. So,
yes.
I mean, it is
tiebreaker the Lions have if they're tied.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not convinced.
The Vikings play the Packers too.
As I say, I'm not convinced the Vikings will make it to that game with the same amount of losses that we think. But yeah, the one seed's going to hinge on Philadelphia. It almost feels certain. They're playing great football. And
right. And their schedule, they do have to go on the road and take on Washington. And then it's home games against the Cowboys and the Giants. So, yeah.
Assuming they don't just get in a giant fight and all kill each other on the sidelines, because apparently that's what's going on in Philly.
I know.
They all just hate each other, but they're still winning.
My ilk. All right. Our thanks to Zach Clark for producing, staying up late and doing it. And don't forget, you can get the Detroit Football Network podcasts where you get all your podcasts, whether it's Odyssey, Apple, Spotify, anything else, right?
Yeah, sure. They're around.
Justin and Will Birchfield will be joining you sometime during the week. Have a great, great week, everyone. And we'll talk to you again. Justin will be in Chicago. I'll be in the comfort of Southfield at a 1 o'clock game. God, how nice is that going to be?
I mean, soak it in. It's probably going to be our last one of the year, Stoney.
Oh, yes, it will be. All right. See ya.
Oh. I'm Anna Garcia, host of True Crime News, the podcast. Every week, we bring you in-depth coverage on cases making headlines, as well as those that go under the radar. Tune in for Murders That Defy Explanation, Mystery Seeking Exploration, and Shocking Secrets That Will Leave You Breathless. Each week, we honor the victims by going beyond the salacious in our search for justice. Crime never stops. And neither do we. Listen to True Crime News, available now on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.